The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, uupinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining you this week is one of our favorites, New York State Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay. Leader Barclay, good to have you back with us. I always get straight answers from you, and I'm so pleased you're with us.
Thanks for having me on. Always good talking with you.
Hey, Will, the legislature changes the election law, so former Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, who resigned after being indicted in a corruption probe, could remove himself from the ballot. Governor Hochul then chose the 19th District Democratic Congressman Antonio Delgado as her new lieutenant governor. Take it, Will Barclay.
I think it's an example of trying to change the rules in the middle of the game. I think we might have been open. In fact, we offered a couple hostile amendments to this. We did that one would change the date. The other thing I think is troublesome about this, it doesn't require any legislative input. Like, for instance, in the federal government, if the vice president resigns or has to leave office, to replace that, you need legislative approval. I think it's a good idea. Why should the governor be able to just appoint someone that's going to potentially replace whoever the governor is if the governor resigns without any voter input or legislative input?
Well, if you were in that position, wouldn't you want to just be able to say, oh, well, that guy didn't work out. Can I name somebody?
But why shouldn't the legislature have a voice in that? In fact, we have it for the AG. We have it for the comptroller. I don't think that's unreasonable. And if you hypothetically, whether this ever would happen or not, but I've seen crazy things happen in Albany, the governor could make a deal, have her lieutenant governor resign. She could then resign herself and appoint her replacement for the top spot in state government without any input from anybody else. So this does certainly smell of politics. And it was expedient for her to get Benjamin off the ballot because he's under corruption charges. And she wanted to do it for political reasons, I'm sure.
Well, what do you think it says about a governor who would choose a running mate who had these charges pending against them?
It's really a mystery to me. Obviously, the politics, I think, for her lieutenant governor pick was to get someone downstate, someone who's viewed as a liberal. And Benjamin checked that box. But there's a lot of other candidates out there that would also check that box. So it's baffling to me that she went with Benjamin to begin with, because none of these charges were necessarily a secret or a mystery, even when she selected him as her lieutenant governor. So it just seems like it's very poor judgment to me and what her end game was, whether it's politically or, based on substance, what she was actually doing.
Yeah, but from where I'm sitting, this is not your answer, but mine. It was a dumb move. She didn't do her homework.
Right, without a doubt.
So polls are showing that it might not be as easy for Governor Hochul to be elected as we might have once thought. We also see Governor Cuomo could play a spoiler role. Is there a scenario here where a Republican can win the governor's seat?
I believe so, and we've talked about this a number of times before. I think there's a lot of issues that aren't necessarily partisan issues, but can be viewed as nonpartisan. Take crime, for instance. We're seeing spikes in violent crime throughout the state. Some voters that have in the past have left the Republican Party are coming back to the Republican Party because they're concerned. And I think of suburban women being one voting bloc that would maybe in the past hadn't voted for Republicans, but might just because they're concerned about crime, they're concerned about education, they're worried about inflation. And the Democrats really can't run anywhere. They control the federal government. They control every, seat in the state government. And so they can't blame it on anyone. It's their own policies that are bringing some of this on us. And so I do feel optimistic, probably the most optimistic I've been in my political career, that a Republican can capture the governor's mansion this election.
It's not as if George Pataki never lived. He did win three times, right?
As a
Republican.
It's true.
Will Barclay, I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the people I've been talking to are not happy about the Buffalo Bills Stadium. Now, you're a bit of an upstater, not a bit. You are an upstater.
I am.
Yeah. And this is an issue that voters don't like, apparently. Where do you stand on the new stadium?
Well, I don't think she hammered, got a good deal. Let's put it this way. I am a Bills fan. I'd love to see the Bills stay in New York. But I think it's very reasonable to ask, you know, why is state government paying $800 million to keep the Bills when you have billionaires already owning the team? Why are we subsidizing that? Now, is it unrealistic to expect us to do some things? I think so. And again, we do it all the time for economic development reasons, other reasons supporting. But to spend this much money, I think the public's pretty right to question, is this a good use of taxpayers' money?
You know, Will Barclay, I've been on you about the Trump connection in the Republican Party since you've been on the show, and you've been on several times, and I'm sure you're getting tired of me saying, Alan, bring something else up. But it seems to me there's got to be a connection in the voters' minds between the Republican Party and Donald Trump. What do you think?
Well, I think he does still play a role in the party, but I think, as I've told you before, that's not our focus here and not our focus in our conference, the Republicans in the Assembly. You know, everybody likes to bring up Donald Trump. I can't think at any time in conference his name's come up where we're concerned about it. We really are focused on New York. We're focused on winning more Assembly seats going forward, and we're focused on hopefully taking back some of these statewide offices. And the way we're going to do that is keep focusing on the problems that we have in the state that are a result of poor policies put forth by the Democratic majorities and the governor.
How are you getting along with Speaker Hastie?
I've always had a nice relationship with, I think there's a mutual respect. I like the speaker, although we are really at complete opposite ends when it comes to ideology. But, you know, I think our relationship is fine.
Did you ever have a fight with him?
Have I? Yes. Many times.
But I always,
as I've said from the beginning, I never, with any, you know, politics, people differ on stuff, but I try never to make it personal. It never is personal. I have great respect for him. I have a lot of respect for other people on the other side of the aisle, even though I don't agree with them politically.
What do you think about Kathy Hochul pulling Delgado into the race as her lieutenant governor candidate?
Well, again, I'm upset about how the whole process went down. I don't think Benjamin should have been able to, but putting that aside, at least she did pick someone that is at least from the Hudson Valley or upstate, so hopefully he has some understandings of the issues we face there, and he allegedly is more moderate than maybe some of the, certainly Benjamin, but maybe some other the candidates out there. So from that perspective, that doesn't upset me. I think she could have done a lot worse with that pick.
So, Will Barclay, I guess I got to ask you about the abortion and leaked draft opinion from the Supreme Court, which suggests that Roe v. Wade may be overturned, and Governor Hochul gathered with other Democratic lawmakers and pro-choice advocates for a rally this week where the governor said New York was ready to help those in need of the procedure. What do you make of this leaked report and the role Governor Hochul says New York will play?
Well, let's talk about the leak, because I think it's very concerning. And I feel like it was done strictly for political purposes. They want to obviously change the narrative. I think some Democratic activists feel like abortion is a hot-button issue that might get their base out. But we don't know. I mean, although I know the chief judge did say this was, you know, as an actual document, it wasn't a fake, but they haven't made the decision. I think it would be wise to hold off and see what the actual end decision is. I clerked for, you probably remember Judge Minor on the Second Circuit when I was out of law school. I had a great experience, but the one thing, the judge, if I ever said anything, you know, he was a Republican, I guess, and there was certainly several progressives on the Second Circuit, but he respected every one of them and respected their legal arguments, their legal ability. And as a clerk, you know, if I ever said anything negative about the other judge, he would, I think I made that mistake once, bite back at me very hard. And I think it's a tragedy that whether, now we don't know for sure whether it was a clerk that leaked it, but whoever leaked it, I hope they find out and they're severely punished, because it does undermine the ability of the court to act if people are going to leak draft decisions out there, and particularly on an issue like Roe v. Wade, which is obviously a very hot-button political issue.
Well, yeah, that's right, and let's go there, Will. I know that you might not want to, but but should a woman have the right to have an abortion if she wants one?
Well, she has it in New York State.
Yeah, well, and what about the rest of the country?
Overturn of Roe v. Wade is not going to have any impact on that at all. I'm pro-life. But, you know, in New York, I think you can have an abortion up to 6 months now, or beyond that, if it depends on the health of the life of the mother. So we already have very, very expansive abortion laws codified in law in New York State. So I don't know what we're going to do differently, other than I think, you know, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are trying to make a political issue of it. But really, this, if we overturn Roe v. Wade tomorrow, it's not going to make any difference in New York State as far as people having abortion rights.
So let me ask you this, Will Barclay. Let's go to redistricting. This is interesting. Fascinating, as a matter of fact. The Democrats did what, you know, comes naturally, and they reapportioned basically so that they could maximize every seat that they had, every congressional seat. Had national implications. And then you guys and the Republicans took them to court, and the court, the Democratic appointed court, said, no, this is just wrong. You got to play by fairer rules than this, right?
Yeah, it was a surprise decision. I felt strongly about the congressional maps. You know, we voted on the legislative maps, we voted on the congressional maps. It certainly doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the congressional maps and say, boy, these seem like these were gerrymandered for political purposes. I live in Oswego County. The proposed congressional person would be Chris Jacobs for that county. He lives in Niagara County. So, and by the way, it goes up into Jefferson County, too. So you look at it, and then it goes underneath Rochester. So you look at it, and it didn't take any big mystery of what was going on there. They're clearly being gerrymandered for the political advantage for the Democrats. And, you know, the state lines, interestingly enough, I thought, obviously, the Dems now having control of the state Senate, we're going to do everything they can to not give the Republicans any hope of getting back in the majority. But interestingly, Alan, in our, we did not litigate the lines. Actually, in our House, the lines were passed on a bipartisan manner. I voted for them because I felt they were actually reasonable. And so we weren't part of that litigation. We may get pulled back into it. There's some people that are trying to intervene to get the assembly lines thrown out. But let's say this is a complete mess, obviously. And I think the voters are confused. I know people involved in politics are confused of what happens next. We're going to maybe have a bifurcated primary where the Senate and congressional will have their primary dates in August. But the statewide and maybe for now the assembly will be the primaries based in June. That's confusing enough. And a lot of things are based on the assembly lines themselves. So if they get thrown out, we have judicial delegates, we have state committee people, we have local committee people all run for election based on the assembly lines. If those get thrown out, particularly now we're moving through the year closer to election date, I think that's going to create tremendous chaos. So what the Democrats did, I think, unfortunate. They just went too far. And the fact is they're paying the price for that now.
Wow. Wow. How do you reconnoiter, if that's the right word, on all of this? You know, in other words, this comes down. You have colleagues. Do you conference them? Do they, you say, what should we do? And can you let us in on what your colleagues think about this all?
Well, in our conference, again, it was split. Some people upset, voted against the lines because they felt the process was faulty, which the courts upheld that we weren't following the Constitution. I think ultimately we all wanted the independent, at least in our conference, we wanted the Independent Redistricting Commission to come to some sort of agreement on maps, but that didn't happen. In the meantime, they passed the assembly maps. I think I would say, I can't speak for everybody in our conference, but I think the majority of our conference felt that those maps were probably the fairest. And we'll see what happens if they get put in with a special master. Who knows what will happen going forward there. So it's an influx, I think. And it's too bad because it didn't need to be this way. As I said, I just think the Democrats took advantage of the power they had with the supermajorities in both houses, and they went too far, and the court knocked them down, rightfully so.
You got to respect the Democratic court.
Very much so.
For doing that, don't you think?
I thought it was a well-written decision, frankly.
Will Barclay, New York has closed 6 state prisons, many upstate. You did not support this idea. Has there been any fallout so far, and why didn't you support it?
Well, if you know, even first of all, one of the prisons was a drug treatment center, and the fact that we're shutting down a drug treatment center when we're having a drug epidemic in New York State just seems a little bit backwards to me. But as you know, although the prison population has been declining, in the past, prisons have been overcrowded. They've been double bunked, et cetera. And the fact to quickly just close six prisons, I think they're doing it for the wrong reasons. I think their thought is there's no prisons. We can't put people in jail. And that's not my mentality. My mentality is if you break a law, you ought to go to jail. And we ought to have the facilities to accommodate that. The other issue I think we have to be concerned about, there has been a spike in inmate-on-inmate violence, but also violence against correction officers. And I think if you cut the jail amount of jails down and increase the jail population, the ones the jails we keep open, I think there's no doubt that that increase is going to get even more more violence in those.
Well, Will Barclay, it must be, I mean, you know, I'm going to ask you this. Most of those prisoners are coming from the metropolitan area in New York. And most of these prisons that they want to shut down are upstate.
Right.
How does that figure? In other words, shouldn't the prisons be closer to where the families of the prisoners might be?
Perhaps, but that's where the scenario we're in. For whatever reason, the prisons were built up there. Maybe I don't think we ought to look at the prison system as an economic development tool. That I don't necessarily agree with, but I think we ought to look at it dispassionately. And again, I don't think just by saying we ought to shut down prisons because we don't like people having to go to prison is the right mentality. I think there needs to be the right population. We want to make sure that inmates are safe wherever they're incarcerated, and we want to make sure correction officers are safe wherever they work. And I'm not sure that system's working. I don't think shutting down additional prisons, or at least six of them, necessarily, and do it quickly, as the governor wanted. You know, it's supposed to take a year to evaluate this. They bypass that process, too, I think is problematic.
So, Leader Barclay, do you think that the Democrats are soft on crime?
I think there's no doubt. No doubt about it, Alan. You look at the policies that they've passed, whether it's bail reform, raise the age, or just following that defund the police narrative. But they want to go farther. They want to do the clean slate bill, which you can't look at someone's criminal record. They want to let any felon out of jail if you're over 50 years old, 55, excuse me. So we've seen this, and I'm not saying this for political reasons. Look at the statistics going around. I saw a statistic, I think in Albany, shooting crimes are up something like 350% since 2019. And it's not just Albany, it's not just New York City, it's across all of New York. And it's a direct result. We don't pass laws in a vacuum and they just theoretically do it. There's real life impact as a result, and we're seeing that as a result of the increased crime rates.
So if you had your way and you really wanted to put a stop to all of that, what would be the first thing you would do?
Well, I think the first thing is pull back on bail reform, so-called reform. And I think also that goes with raise the age too. Just taking raise the age, you know, it's not helping anybody. They're letting basically children back out on the street. It's not good for, certainly it's not good for the victims of the crimes, but it's not great for the perpetrators that probably really shouldn't, you know, be allowed straight back on the street. It's not helping them be reformed or whatever else you're trying to accomplish by the incarcerating them. So I would take bail reform as giving judges discretion. Interestingly, Alan, you hear a lot about, you know, what can you do as Republicans in New York State? Well, we do have an impact. And as you know, in the budget 2 years ago with Governor Cuomo, he made some reforms to the so-called bail reform. And we did some in this year's budget. But we need to go farther. And I really feel strongly that judges should have discretion when it comes to keeping dangerous criminals behind bars versus just having to let them back out on the street.
Well, I think that it may have been bad thinking on the part of some of your new progressive politicians in the Assembly and the Senate, some of the younger ones who really believed that the people would reward them for some of the things you're reacting negatively to. Do you think that I'm wrong about that?
Well, I think first of where they come from, maybe they'll be rewarded by, you know, obviously New York City and some of the liberal constituencies down there. But overall, I think people, New Yorkers, are waking up to it and questioning. You know, I don't think anyone was opposed to some sort of reform of the cash bail system. I know we were, but just like everything, unfortunately, with particularly the extreme left, they took a chainsaw when we should have used a scalpel on these policies. So I don't want to say that we're against everything, and their system always can reform, whether it's criminal justice or, you know, economics or whatever system you're talking about. But they have taken it to the extreme, and as a result, we're seeing some bad policies causing bad reactions in New York.
Would you like to see ex-Governor Cuomo back in the political race? Do you think it would help
No.
the Republicans?
It probably would help us politically, but come on, we need to turn the page on Governor Cuomo. You know, I was always more enraged than anything about the nursing homes and the cover-up of the fatalities in nursing homes. I thought that was really an inexcusable, I don't know if you go far as a crime, but certainly someone needed to be held accountable. I'm glad he resigned, but I think it's time for us to move on from Cuomo.
So let's talk a little bit about inflation. Does that help the Republicans when New Yorkers have to pay a lot more for some bread or milk?
Yeah, isn't it incredible? I cannot go into the grocery store without spending $50 or more, even when you run in for a few items. And I think it's really eye-opening. So obviously, same with gas, same with home products, you know, all sorts of things. The prices are going through the roof, and that really hurts the hardworking families of New York to, you know, when their dollar doesn't go that far, it's hard to get ahead. And so we propose, obviously, we're happy to take the gas tax off, state gas tax off. And that was a good step in the right direction. But there's a lot more we could do in that regard. We could take off of some food products. We could take the sales tax off. We could take home products. We could take the sales tax off. So I think we can do more to help try to provide some relief against inflation.
How then could you support, you know, the government if you start to give so much money back to the voters?
Well, I always said, let's talk about one thing we can do. In New York, our budget was $220 billion. I repeat that, $220 billion. And you put that in perspective with the rest of the country, we are way out of whack with it. Even California, state twice the size of New York, I think their budget is something like $260 billion. We're catching up with them in a state, and they're hardly fiscal conservatives. I wouldn't consider them. We have bigger budgets than Florida and Texas, which are also two states bigger than us. So I think, listen, we don't have to cut. I think if we just slowed the growth of spending, we could do a lot. And some of what we do is give some of the taxpayers money back to them. And this is one way of doing it, is to cut the sales tax on various products.
You know, you're still a young man. Does this get you tired? Your dad was a very prominent and wonderful politician. Do you ever wake up, you know, and say, you know, that's enough of this?
Well, I'm not as young as I used to. I would say that much.
How old are you?
We all are that way. I'm 53.
Well, so. To an 80-year-old, that looks awfully young.
Yeah, right. Well, you're young at heart, Alan, no doubt. But I love the job I have because I love, one, having a voice and trying to have an impact on policy in New York State, and I find that very rewarding. But I also really enjoy the people I work with. I'm honored and privileged to lead a tremendous conference of hardworking assembly members that are trying to do right by New York State. So that is enjoyable. But I would say, just like any job, you have good days and bad days. And some days are fun and you feel like you're getting ahead. And other days you want to go crazy, pull your hair out. But I don't think that's any different.
Well, at least you have some hair.
Yeah, barely, but that's true. I pulled a lot of it out.
Now, you've endorsed Lee Zeldin, who is obviously running for governor. Most of us think he hasn't got, you know, a chicken's chance in all of this thing. Mm-hmm. Yet you did it. Is that because of the Trumpian influence in the party?
No, that had no role whatsoever with me. First of all, Lee called me and asked me, and I like him. I served with him, obviously, in the state legislature. I think he was accomplished in Congress. I think he's a person of integrity. I like to stand on most of the issues, so it wasn't a hard choice for me to endorse Lee. And I feel very optimistic that the first time in a long time that Republicans can win back the governor's mansion.
When you assess a move you've made, do you ever think back to your father and what he would have you do, or whether he'd be proud of what you're doing?
I hope he'd be proud. Every day I think about him, and every day I try to emulate him the best I can. And I think I've mentioned to you before, One thing my father was very good at was listening to other people and not being insistent that he was right all the time. And I try to follow that. I know, obviously, in elected office, egos often come with that. But I try to realize that I'm not always right, and you need to listen to other people. And that's something he taught me and something I try to live by.
And let me just tell you that our families mean a great deal to us. My phone has been ringing in the middle of this interview, and my wife has been on the other end, and she probably wonders why I hung up on her three times. Now that's very dangerous, isn't it?
That is. That's very dangerous. If you need to get off and take the call, I completely understand.
Don't blame it on me. I would never. Oh, yeah. You know, my friend Will Barclay, he's a Republican. Yeah. He did it. And she'd say, Okay, so therefore, the question is, there's a good deal out there now about ethics reform. What do you think we could do so people have more faith in the legislative process?
Well, one thing, I think elected officials have to realize that they're not doing this for, they shouldn't be doing this for themselves, but they should be doing it for the constituents that they represent. So that's the first thing, and sometimes I think that gets lost, particularly here in Albany. But one thing I've always said about ethics reform is, unfortunately, in my mind, we're a very blue state, and Democrats control a lot of the levers, if not all the levers, of power. But for one reason, ethics ought to be truly a bipartisan. Whoever oversees ethics should be bipartisan, because the Republicans have an interest in keeping the Democrats accountable, and the Democrats have an interest in keeping Republicans accountable, and that's the only way. How we do it now is, it seems like the legislature maybe wants to try the governor be accountable, and the governor wants to try to hold the legislature accountable, but they're all Democrats. And ultimately, in the end of the day, they want to try to make sure Democrats either stay in power or elect more Democrats. So why should it be a partisan, you know, why should Democrats be able to completely control any ethics body if there's one? Obviously, we got rid of J-COPE, and now we have this next iteration of, I forget what the commission's called.
I agree with you.
But it's controlled
you
know, by Democrats.
You can't let them do that. It has to be an outside force, and a real outside force.
Right.
Maybe the Court of Appeals. Right. You know, maybe Professor Jerry Benjamin, you know, the Republican, yep, should have a role in it. Hey, Will Barclay, I love having you on the show. It's fun. I always enjoy it. We can really mix it up, and we can have a lot of fun. And I thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate, as always, talking with you, Alan.